Welcome to today's reading of the Waterloo Cedar Falls Courier for Friday, May 22nd. I'm your reader, Wanda, and here is our first story. Deere's earnings report shows net income down 41% in the second quarter. Moline-based Deere & Company reported its latest financial earnings this morning. It reported net income of $665.8 million for the second quarter that ended May 3rd, or $2.11 per share, compared to $1.135 billion, $3.52 per share for 2019's second quarter. In a news release this morning, ahead of an earnings call with investors, Deere said net income for the first 6 months of the year was $1.182 billion, or $3.73 per share, compared with $1.63 billion, or $5.07 per share for the same period a year ago. John Deere's foremost priority in confronting the coronavirus crisis has been to safeguard the health and well-being of employees while fulfilling its obligation as an essential business serving customers throughout the world, said John C. May, Chairman and Chief Executive Officer. We've had good success in these areas thanks to the proactive measures we have taken to keep employees safe and our production facilities and parts distribution centers operational. At the same time, the company has reached out to our local communities to help those in need as a result of the pandemic. Deere and its employees have provided generous support to area food banks and other organizations offering assistance during this difficult time. Ag and turf net sales and revenue were down 18% in the quarter, down 13% for the first 6 months. Construction and forestry net sales and revenue were down 25% in the quarter, down 18% for the first 6 months. Deere did beat analyst predictions for the second consecutive quarter, as Zacks' consensus estimate for Deere's earnings per share was $1.99. Deere reported its earnings at $2.11 per share this morning. Mediacom Waterloo Schools helped more than 350 families gain internet access, by Andrew Wind. With the help of Mediacom Communications, more than 350 families in the Waterloo Community Schools have gained access to high-speed internet for their children's educational needs since April 7th. Last week, broadband installation was completed for the final set of families, 5 weeks after district leaders put in motion a plan to ensure that its students would have the technology to access online learning following the state-mandated closure of schools in March due to the coronavirus pandemic. District officials distributed school Chromebooks to students in second through fifth grade. Waterloo School's technology team developed a plan to work with local broadband providers to help fill gaps for students without internet access at home. Secondary students always had school-issued Chromebook computers through an existing technology initiative. Mediacom adapted its Connect to Compete program, a low-cost internet service for students who are eligible for free or reduced-price school meals, to assist the district. Internet service was installed in the homes of more than 175 families through the program. In addition, the company activated internet service for another 172 families who chose individual subscriptions using the program, paying a flat rate monthly fee of $9.95 with no contract or deposit. In response to COVID-19, New families eligible for the program can go 60 days of complimentary, can get 60 days of complimentary internet service. Education quality equality is a top priority for Waterloo schools. And in 2020, an internet connection and computer are essential components in the equity equation. Matt O'Brien, Waterloo Schools Executive Director for Technology, said in a news release. Mediacom's broadband network is widely available throughout our community, and we were pleased with the company's willingness to step forward to be part of the solution and the investment we needed. The school district is responsible for monthly internet service offered at the same discount rate of $9.95 for each household within a bulk service agreement. Mediacom donated 100% of the costs for installation, labor, and materials, including a no-cost lease for the Wi-Fi-equipped modems activated in each home. We previously made a commitment to invest company resources in a meaningful way that helps low-income families gain the connectivity they need to support their children's education. Corey Bowman, Mediacom's Area Operations Director, said in a news release. He noted that in a COVID-19 world, a connection to Mediacom's fiber-based network is more essential than ever. $1 million curriculum proposal gets funded before Waterloo School Board. After its purchase was pulled from a prior Board of Education meeting, the case for an elementary school literacy curriculum got a full hearing Thursday. The board held a two-hour work session to learn more about the Fountas and Pinnell classroom curriculum that would cost Waterloo Community Schools $1.18 million to adopt for its kindergarten through fifth grade students. It had been on the agenda of an April 13th board meeting, but was taken off that morning at the request of members. There were some questions from the school board, said Superintendent Jane Lindemann. She noted that the curriculum has a big price tag, and a number of community members have raised concern about the content. So the work session was planned to ensure board members felt comfortable with the proposed adoption. The committee, made up of district educators, spent 2 years studying the needs of Waterloo School students, reviewing the research, and examining curriculum choices before making the recommendation. A special meeting could be held next week to ensure, if it is adopted, the district will be able to order materials and complete professional development before the start of classes this fall. If that doesn't happen, Lindemann said, officials will not pursue a mid-year implementation of new curriculum. This is hundreds of teachers, so we can't just do that, she noted. Officials say the proposed curriculum is one component of a comprehensive approach to teaching literacy in the district. Students learn through word study or phonics, a number of approaches to reading like shared, guided, and independent reading, reading aloud in class, and writing. Some media reports have connected Fontas and Pinnell's products to whole language literacy. That doesn't focus on breaking down and decoding words by sounding them out in a phonics approach. Stephanie Mahorney, Assistant Superintendent for Educational Services, noted years ago as a teacher, she was trained in the whole language approach, but no longer believes in its effectiveness. There's no way I would support this if it had anything to do with whole language, she said. Lindemann suggested that concerns voiced by Waterloo School's parents about Fontas and Pinnell were over its own phonics curriculum. She noted, though, that that's not part of what the district's proposed purchasing. 3 years ago, the board adopted what Lindemann said is a better foundation skills or phonics curriculum. Really great reading. 2 years ago, the board adopted another curriculum piece, Patterns of Power. Between that and the proposed purchase, the materials added focus on skills like language and reading comprehension that are essential to the district's approach. The Fontes and Pinnell purchase would replace a 12-year-old curriculum adopted before the Iowa Core Standards were in place. As a result, it does not meet all the standards and needs to be supplemented by quite a bit of other materials, said Lindemann. With this, we are really looking at the needs of every single student, said Jen Hartman, Director of Education, Elementary Education. The curriculum includes $1.08 million in instructional materials and $99,991 for classroom libraries that will ensure consistency across district elementary schools. The teachers are now all going to have the same resources, said Hartman, which will allow them to differentiate instruction for students with varying needs. She added that the curriculum includes a phenomenal assessment component that will help determine those needs. Waterloo Test Iowa site closed, moved to Marshall County, by Amy Rivers. Despite the governor's announcement that anyone who wanted a Test Iowa test could now get an appointment for one, the state will be closing the Test Iowa State in Waterloo on Friday and moving it to Marshall County, local officials said Thursday. The Waterloo Test Iowa site would be shut down Friday afternoon, Blackhawk County Sheriff Tony Thompson said in a county's now weekly coronavirus briefing. The testing site set up in the Crossroads Mall parking lot since April 29th accounted for less than 12% of all tests taken in Blackhawk County. And Blackhawk County residents can choose to be tested in Marshall County or any other of the 7 Test Iowa sites throughout the state, which can be found at coronavirus.iowa.gov. But Blackhawk County officials were still puzzled as to why Governor Kim Reynolds would remove a coronavirus testing site from the 5th highest population center in Iowa. I don't know the rubric or the methodology behind why it's being moved, particularly at a time they are opening up the criteria for who can be tested, said Thompson. It doesn't make any sense to me. County Health Director Dr. Nafisa Kaisa-Ibiani said Blackhawk County added 8 new cases Thursday for a total of 1,877 cases, or 1.4% of the total population, with 1,036 of those individuals already recovered. The county remained at 37 deaths from COVID-19, a 1.97% fatality rate. While the county currently has 4 long-term care facility outbreaks, with 2 of those facilities adding new cases Thursday, it also seen its curve flatten, with the hard-hitting Tyson outbreak in Waterloo largely over with, according to health officials. By contrast, Marshall County is at 835 cases, or over 2% of its total population. It has had 7 total deaths and 2 long-term care outbreaks affecting 71 residents and staff, including at the state-run Iowa Veterans Home. Thompson said the county's hospitals and clinics were requesting extra test kits to compensate for the loss of the site, which they can now order directly from the state hygienic lab. And he wasn't entirely sad to see the site go, knowing it uses law enforcement time and resources every day it's open. Test Iowa has been a bit of a quagmire for everyone, Thompson said, noting the issues Linn County and others were having getting reliable data from the state was the same as Blackhawk County's experience. There's just been a lot of dysfunction. Most Memorial Day events canceled. With the coronavirus pandemic still active, most Memorial Day events in the metro area have been canceled. There will be no parade in Waterloo, but there will be an online observance which will air on Waterloo Public Access Channel 15 several times beginning Saturday. The times are 8 a.m. and 5 p.m. Saturday, 11 a.m. and 5 p.m. Sunday, 5:30 p.m., 8:30 p.m., and 11 p.m. Monday, and 2:30 a.m. and 6:30 a.m. Tuesday. During the observance, Blackhawk County Supervisor Craig White will read the names of Waterloo veterans who have died since last Memorial Day. No events are planned at the Cedar Falls AMVETS or the Cedar Falls American Legion Centers, but the flags will be up. Personal watercrafts collide on Mississippi, causing injury. On Wednesday at approximately 4:50 p.m., Lansing first responders were dispatched to collision between two personal watercraft, PWC, in the main channel of the Mississippi River, just north of Lansing. Tyler Wild, 17, of New Albany, and Clayton Little, 17, of Lansing, were operating separate PWCs when Wild was coming out of a turn and Little was heading toward Wild down the channel. At that time, both PWCs collided head-on. When Little's PWC hit Wild's, it went up over the top of Wild's, hitting Wild in the head and knocking him unconscious. Wild was laying face down in the water until Little was able to assist him into a nearby boat. Wild was taken to shore where he was provided immediate medical attention. He was transported to Gunderson Lutheran Medical Center in La Crosse, Wisconsin, where he is recovering from his injuries. Little was treated on the scene and released. Both were wearing life jackets. The DNR Law Enforcement Bureau continues to investigate. The Lansing Police Department, Lansing Fire Department, and Lansing EMS responded to the collision. Iowa reaches 400 deaths. Reynolds open up test Iowa sites to anyone by Amy Rivers. Governor Kim Reynolds announced Thursday that testing at the state's 8 test Iowa sites, including Waterloo, would now be open to anyone who thinks they should be tested once they complete a testiowa.com assessment. Reynolds' announcement comes after criticism that not many were able to get tested through Test Iowa sites, despite the $26 million program's ability to test 3,000 Iowans per day. In 3 short weeks, we have significantly ramped up testing, Reynolds said. The governor noted that the state had tested 4,636 people statewide on Wednesday, an all-time high, she said, and said more than 3,000 Iowans have been tested through Test Iowa sites each day since Monday. Later today, we're opening criteria so that anyone who thinks they should be tested can be, Reynolds said, noting the change would be effective late Thursday or maybe until tomorrow. So if you're interested in being tested, please go to Test Iowa and take the assessment, she said. More than 475,000 Iowans have completed a Test Iowa assessment, but only a fraction have been approved for testing so far. In Black Hawk County, that number is just 5%. Reynolds said that with the expanded criteria, those who have taken the assessment will now be able to schedule their own testing appointments. We got so hung up on testing too, Reynolds said, noting other metrics were available to Iowans to monitor the virus, like coronavirus.iowa.gov and the 211 hotline. All of that is really good news for our ability to manage the virus. Iowa remains 14th in the nation among all 50 states and the District of Columbia for cases per capita. It remained 23rd in the deaths per capita. Adding Black Hawk's county's total to the state's 16,159 people in 98 of Iowa's 99 counties have tested positive for coronavirus, or 0.5% of the state's population. Only Decatur County along the Missouri border has no positive cases recorded. As of 10 a.m. Thursday, the state had 400 deaths in 33 counties, and around 2.5% of Iowans who have tested positive for coronavirus have died, with 88% of those over the age of 61. The state remained at 37 long-term care facility outbreaks in 16 counties, adding 38 deaths and 8 deaths among residents, 38 cases and 8 deaths among residents, and staff for a total of 1,529 cases and 218 deaths. Five Iowa counties have had 2% or more of their population test positive: Crawford, Loiza, Marshall, Tama, and Woodbury counties. Another three are over 1%, Black Hawk, Muscatine, and Wapello counties. Nine counties have had 10 or more COVID-19 deaths: Black Hawk, Dallas, Dubuque, Jasper, Lynn, Muscatine, Polk, Tama, and Woodbury counties. The state has a 13.9 positive test rate, lower than Wednesday's 14.1%. The World Health Organization recommends a positive test rate of 10% or less as an adequate testing rate. The Black Hawk County Health Department reported 7 more cases and 3 more deaths for a total of 1,869 cases and 37 deaths Wednesday. The county has 4 long-term care facility outbreaks. Harmony House remained at 89 cases among residents and staff. Friendship Village added 1 case for 47 cases. Pillars of the Cedar Valley remained at 20 cases, and New Aldea Lifescape added 4 cases for a total of 17 cases. Buchanan County added 2 cases for a total of 30 cases. Grundy County added 2 cases for a total of 19 cases. Hardin County added 1 case for a total of 13 cases. Tama County added 9 cases for a total of 376 cases and 21 deaths. The county has 2 long-term care outbreaks. Pinnacle Estates of Toledo remains at 52 cases, and Westbrook Acres added 1 case for a total of 35 cases. Winneshiek County dropped 1 case for a total of 20 cases. The state adjusts numbers downward when a case is mistakenly assigned, officials have said. Iowa sees fewest initial jobless claims since March. Iowa workforce development received 13,040 new unemployment claims and handled another 187,375 continuing unemployment claims last week, the department announced Thursday. It is the lowest number of initial claims filed since March 14th. The state paid almost $51 million in unemployment benefits from May 10th to May 16th, and the federal government paid another $106.8 million in jobless benefits. The federal government has paid $651.3 million in unemployment benefits to Iowans since April 4th. Workers in the manufacturing industry have the most new unemployment claims last week at 4,679, followed by self-employed workers or independent contractors at 1,251, and workers in healthcare or social assistance at 1,216. Initial claims have decreased steadily in May after peaking in April at 64,194 claims. The numbers reflect only people who are actively looking for work and does not necessarily paint a full picture of how many people are out of work. Three arrested in firearms incident in Waterloo. A man caught with a gun Wednesday night told police that the arresting officer saved a life, according to court records. Records state Marquise Brumfield told officers that he grabbed a red .22 caliber pocket pistol from his Russell Road home and took it outside to intimidate Diamond Johnson in the parking lot. When police arrived, Brumfield allegedly handed the weapon to someone else who took it back inside, records state. The defendant stated that, "By me driving by, I saved the victim's life," the officer wrote in a report about the incident. Brumfield was arrested for felon or on possession of a firearm and going armed with intent. He was being held without bond as of Thursday morning. Police also arrested Charles Daniel Allen III, 20, for obstructing prosecution and a felon in possession of a firearm. Julialia Mache Pendleton, 27, for obstruction of prosecution and carrying weapons for allegedly handling the weapon. Pendleton was released from jail pending trial. You are listening to the Waterloo Cedar Falls Courier on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. All material heard on IRIS is intended solely for the use of the blind and print disabled. I'm your reader, Wanda. If you have any comments on this or any other IRIS program, give us a call at 515-243-6833. And now we'll turn to today's obituaries. Danny L. Gibbs, 62, of Waterloo, died May 14th. At Mercy Hospice in Hiawatha. A celebration of life will be held later. Memorials and cards should be sent to Cheryl Gibbs, 1208 Kaplan Drive, Waterloo, Iowa, 50702. Ronald Ron William Bushkowski, Bushkowsky, 83, of Independence died at home of lung cancer Wednesday, May 20th. The visitation will be held from 6 to 8 p.m. today, May 22nd, at Reef Family Center Funeral Home and Crematory in Independence. A graveside service will be 10 a.m. Saturday, May 23rd, at Forest Hills Memorial Garden in Hazleton. Online condolences at www.reeffamilycenter.com. Janice McKinney. Jan was born on December 23, 1946, and passed away May 19, 2020. She married Donald McKinney on September 9, 1965. She retired from John Deere Engine Works on December 23, 2002, after 30 years of service. Survivors include two sons, Donald L., wife Angela McKinney II, and Jeffrey McKinney. Four grandchildren, Nicholas, wife Sarah Cole, Nicole McKinney, Haley Ryder, and Autumn husband Joseph Payton. Also five great-grandchildren preceded in death by son Mark McKinney and husband Donald L. McKinney. Keith R. Albert, 76, formerly of Mason City, died Wednesday, May 20th at Westbrook Acres Nursing Home in Gladbrook. He was born March 4, 1944, in Grundy Center, son of Howard and Gladys Eilers Bowers. He graduated from Dyke High School in 1963. He enlisted in the U.S. Navy and served as a hospital corpsman, achieving rank of HM3. He then graduated from Iowa Teachers College. Keith started his career at Jefferson Elementary, later Monroe Junior High, and lastly finished his career teaching at John Adams Middle School in Mason City. In retirement, he substitute taught. Survivors include nieces Angie, husband Tony Norton, Sarah, husband Rob Heekers, H-E-E-R-K-E-S, and Maureen, husband Justin Stockdale, all of Dyke. A brother-in-law, Glenn Nielsen, great-nephews and nieces, Caitlin, husband Chase, Madeline, Izzy, Jenna, Addie, Jacob, Noah, and Isaac. He was preceded in death by his parents, a brother-in-law, Glenn Alberts, a brother, Kent, and a sister, Kay Nelson. A private interment will be held at Elmwood Cemetery in Dyke on Tuesday, May 26th at 2 p.m. Abel's Funeral and Cremation Service, Dyke Chapel, is handling arrangements. Keith was a man always on the go and rarely sat, spending most of his time outdoors. He was particular around his house and yard, making sure it was always maintained. He enjoyed playing piano and was always singing. He will be dearly missed by those who knew him. Dale Wilson, 77, of Dysart, died Tuesday, May 19th. At New Aldea Lifescapes, Cedar Falls. A private family service will be held with burial at Nigi Cemetery. Memorials to the family, Overton Funeral Home, Dysart, is assisting the family. www.overtonservice.com. Dixie A. Kramer, 68, of Waterloo, died Tuesday, May 19th at Mercy One Waterloo Medical Center. She was born July 23, 1951, in Waterloo, daughter of William J. and Alice H. Nichols Federspiel. Dixie graduated from Jessup High School in 1969. She married Ronald Dake in 1970. They later divorced. She married Robert Bob Kramer on September 6, 1991, in Waterloo. She was a CNA at Schoitz Hospital. She then was a daycare provider for many years. Later, she was a bookkeeper at Carpetland and retired from Warren Transport. She was a member of Blessed Sacrament Catholic Church. Survivors include her husband, two daughters, Michelle, husband Josh Hainsford Dake, and Jennifer, husband Barry Combs, both of Waterloo. Two stepsons, Matt Kramer of Clear Lake and Ryan Kramer of Mason City. A stepdaughter, Laurie Ganson of Clear Lake. 12 grandchildren, 5 great-grandchildren, 2 sisters, Peg Neuendorf and Marge husband Fritz DeMuth, both of Jessup. Four brothers, Nick Federspiel of Cedar Falls, Dan Federspiel, and Larry, wife Vicky Federspiel, both of Jessup, and Billy, wife Cheryl Fettelspear of LaPorte City. Many nieces and nephews and her companion, Ted. Preceded in death by her parents, a nephew, Luke DeMuth, a great-grandchild, Olive Thorpe, two sister-in-laws, Donna and Marlis Federspiel, and a brother-in-law, Ronald Neuendorf. Private services will be held at Locke Funeral Home. Memorials to Kidney Cancer Foundation, 9450 West Southwest Gemini Drive, number 38269, Beaverton, Oregon, 97008-7105, or by visiting www.kidneycancer.org. Cards sent to the funeral home will be forwarded to the family. Online condolences at lockfuneralhome.com. Dixie was one of a kind. She loved her family and being with them. Bob and Dixie also enjoyed spending time at the Mississippi River with their crazy wherever crew. We didn't get to pick you, but we were so glad we got you. Laura Lee Johnson, 56, of Cedar Falls, died Sunday, May 17th at St. Luke's Hospital in Cedar Rapids. Following her wishes, cremation rites have been accorded, and there will be no public visitation or services at this time. The family is planning a gathering at a later date. Burial at Oak Hill Cemetery in New Hartford. Memories to the family. Online condolences at www.ablefuneralhome.com. Megan Hook, 30, of Grundy Center, died Tuesday, May 19th of brain cancer. Public visitation as Celebration of Life will be 1 to 4 p.m. Saturday, May 23rd at Orchard Hill Church, Grundy Campus, 1800 G Avenue, Grundy Center. A private service will be held following the visitation at the church, and a private burial will follow at Rose Hill Cemetery in Grundy Center. Abel's Funeral Home, Funeral and Cremation Service, Anglicus Chapel, is entrusted with arrangements. 319-824-3318. Susan G. Slager Meeks, 68, died Friday, May 15th at Vinton Lutheran Home. Funeral services will be 10:30 a.m. Saturday, May 23rd at Phillips Funeral Home Chapel, 212 East 6th Street, Vinton, following social distancing guidelines. Interment will be at Bear Creek Cemetery, rural Vinton. Online condolences at www.phillipsfuneralhomes.com. Sports. East Athletics charts new path without McGraw and Leonard by Nick Pateros. Waterloo East Athletic Department is in the process of charting a new direction. That vision doesn't appear to include one of the state's most successful basketball coaches, along with a football coach who has shown recent progress. Within the listing of personnel appointments approved during the Waterloo Community School District's May 11th Board of Education meeting, longtime boys basketball coach Steve McGraw and football coach Xavier Leonard didn't have their coaching assignments renewed. Leonard said he was notified over a Zoom call a couple weeks ago with WCSD administrators that his football coaching position would be opened. He reapplied for the job but has yet to receive an opportunity to interview for the position he held over the past four seasons. The football coach was unaware his job was in jeopardy. East went from winless in 2018 to a pair of narrow losses shy of a playoff appearance last fall. "I didn't foresee this coming," said Leonard, who was named the 2019 Co-District Coach of the Year by his peers. "I thought we had a decent season. We were coming along. Growth was happening. But sometimes people want to go a different direction for whatever reason." District Athletics and Activities Director Dan Hoff declined comment on the personnel matters. He released a statement addressing East's current openings. "East High is currently seeking to attract and hire head coaches for football, boys basketball, wrestling, and girls tennis. We are confident that we will be able to hire high-quality candidates for each of these positions." McGraw also declined an opportunity to comment. When he retired from an administrative position at the end of the 2008-2009 school year, McGraw was forced to reapply for his coaching job at East, and the committee opted to go a different direction. He was passed over when the position opened again 3 years later, before succeeding in his third attempt to regain control of the basketball program in 2014. A 2010 Iowa High School Athletic Association Hall of Fame inductee, McGraw ranks 11th on the state's all-time wins chart with a career record of 629 to 375 over a 46-year coaching tenure. He began coaching at East in 1979 and compiled a 514 to 273 record with the Trojans. Tough love could be used to describe McGraw's approach during a career in which he took East to state 13 times with championships in 1990 and 2003. He was just as likely to bench a star player as someone who only played a handful of minutes, holding members of his team accountable for taking care of academic responsibilities and working to find success on the court. "Anybody involved in coaching for any length of time hopes in some small part that they have made that guy or that girl a better person," McGraw told former Courier sports editor Doug Newhoff during an interview prior to coaching his 1,000th career game in February. "I don't think it's the job of a coach to be their friend, and I don't care if some of them don't like me much. Sometimes you tell them truths and they don't want to hear those truths. Sometimes you've got to tell them, if you want to know what the problem is, go home and look in the mirror. Sometimes you've got to tell them that maybe they can work harder or do something better." McGraw's most successful teams often outworked opposition with smothering full court defense, producing points in transition. East made 12 state tournament appearances and 5 trips to the championship game over a 16-year run of dominance from 1989 through 2004. The Trojans finished 11-10 in the 2008-2009 season prior to McGraw's departure and didn't produce another winning series until after he returned. While this past season's East team went 6-16, McGraw saw potential within a roster that didn't have a senior among its top 7 scorers. "Sometimes it's hard to see with young kids because they're inconsistent and their effort and attitude isn't always there," McGraw said after each East challenged eventual state semifinalist Cedar Falls throughout a competitive 6-point loss in February. "They think you're picking on them, but as they get older and more experienced, those things get better. Tonight should go a long way in explaining to them, hey, this is the number two team in the state, Cedar Falls, and they're good, they're big, and we battled them. On the football field, East appeared to be turning a corner under Leonard's leadership. After guiding Belmont Clemmy to playoff runs in his first two seasons at that school, Leonard took on a new challenge at East, where he inherited a program that hadn't won a game over its three previous seasons with two different coaches at the helm. Numbers were so low during Leonard's first season that East had to forfeit its final game against Cedar Falls with just 16 available players on the roster. This past season, Leonard maintained a varsity roster of 50 in addition to nearly 30 freshmen. I got to the point where we were running out of helmets, Leonard said. My first year, I had plenty of helmets. Lately, we've been running out. That's a good thing when you've got kids coming out for football and participating because numbers help. Led by a 17-person senior class, the Trojans were competitive throughout last fall's slate. Tradition-rich Decorah edged East by a touchdown, and West Delaware won by a single point in the season finale of a 3-6 pro campaign that included three losses by 7 points or less. I had a good group of seniors, Leonard said. They were freshmen when I came in, and I guess I'm going out with them. Leonard acknowledged change goes with the territory in coaching. He still serves as a school administrative manager within the district, assisting with student behavior. I still want to be here, Leonard said. We'll see what happens. I love East High football. Change has been occurring at the top. In 2018, Huff was hired as the Waterloo School's district athletic director. Joseph Parker was named East High School principal, and Kinsley Botchway II served as the chief officer of human resources and equity. Tim Moses will take over at East athletic director for Brenton Shavers in July, while also providing input during the process of filling current coaching vacancies at the school. In the past couple of board meetings, we've seen quite a bit of proposed turnover at East, Waterloo School Board member Aster Williams said during the most recent Board of Education meeting. I'm just curious to know what we're looking for going forward. Botchway responded, there's a change that is occurring as far as the vision for East High. I know that many of you know the history of East High and what it has meant to athletics, not only in the community, but also in the state. I don't want to put that entire burden on Tim Moses, but it's something that he's spoken candidly about as far as the standards, the expectation of how we, not only as students, should be moving and representing East and representing Waterloo Community Schools, but also how coaches should as well. We will be working earnestly over the next couple of weeks and months to get many of those positions filled. Lyle Schmidt was the lone board member to vote against the most recent personnel appointments that included a non-renewal of coaching assignment for McGraw and Leonard. Schmidt expressed a need for proper policy and process to be in place. He suggested defining district and sports-specific goals with yardsticks of measurement that could include items such as win-loss record, academic performance of athletes, squad sizes, and college scholarships. Everybody needs job security, Schmidt said. I think any coach interviewing right now, with the changeover we've experienced, would have to consider it a high-risk job. I would suggest it's important to put the policy in place, put all the goals and objectives down, and then hire to get the best fit for those specific goals and objectives. Otherwise, you're saying, come and coach for us, but will determine later whether you're doing well based on some unspecified measurement. Botchwell responded, "There's definitely some room for improvement. We do have some things in place that have led us to what we've done so far. But I think going through this process recently and looking over my tenure for the last 2 years, I'd wholeheartedly agree with you. There's definitely some things we need to clean up, not only for East, but looking at athletics across the board. Even as an AD, that we're clear on our expectations." UNI swimmer Taylor earns COSIDA recognition. University of Northern Iowa standout Katie Taylor has been named a COSIDA, COSIDA Academic All-District Honoree, as announced by the organization on Thursday. COSIDA recognizes the nation's top student athletes for their combined performances in athletic competition and in the classroom. Academic All-America honorees will be announced from June 16th to 19th. Taylor earned first team Missouri Valley Conference honors after she won the 200 backstroke title and finished in the top eight in six other events at the MVC Championship. Taylor has maintained a 3.97 GPA in financial management and was previously named the 2019-2020 MVC Scholar Athlete of the Year. MLB. The Baseball Players Association gave management a wide-ranging response Thursday to a 67-page proposed set of protocols for a season to be played during the coronavirus pandemic. Management had presented the union and the 30 teams the proposed draft last Friday. The union said Thursday it addressed protection for high-risk players, access to pre- and post-game therapies, testing frequency, protocols for positive tests, in-stadium medical personnel, and sanitation procedures. Players viewed many of the concepts in the original draft as over the top, such as arriving in uniform at the ballparks, a prohibition on them leaving without team permission, and a ban on guests other than immediate family members. Players also objected to a ban on the use of showers and hydrotherapy. The union wants more frequent testing than management's proposed multiple times per week. MLB is expected to make an economic proposal to the union within a few days. MLB hopes to start the season by early July. The NBA seems on the cusp of a comeback plan. Something is finally clear in the uncertain NBA. Players believe they're going to play games again this season. The obvious questions, how, where, and when, remain unanswered. Testing, part of the new normal of this coronavirus era, will be a major component of any return to play plan that the NBA comes up with. The Disney campus near Orlando, Florida, makes so much sense, given its massive size, multiple courts, and its ties to league broadcast partner ESPN. And the sooner games begin, the sooner the process of figuring out our next season can start as well. Several people familiar with the details of the conversation have told the Associated Press this week that players around the league are being urged to start getting mentally and physically ready for training camps that could be just a few weeks away. It might not be a unanimous approved notion, but 2.5 months into this pandemic-caused shutdown, the NBA finally seems on the cusp of being able to move forward. I have faith in Adam Silver and the NBA and the NBA teams. They're not going to leave us come back if it's even a question of guests getting hurt, Jared Dudley of the Los Angeles Lakers said this week. And that's where the testing, being clean, and doing everything that I feel that they'll be due to keep us safe. But in a season where the NBA is certainly going to lose money, quite possibly $1 billion or more, there is an obvious appetite for getting back to work if safety can be assured. This has been like being an anxious kid that wants to do something but can't, or an anxious dog where you tell him to sit and he looks at you like, come on, bro, and his tail starts wagging because he's so excited. All-star Bam Adebayo of the Miami Heat said, it's been a whole spectrum of the unknown. That brings us to the end of today's reading of the Waterloo Cedar Falls Courier. I'm your reader, Wanda. Thanks for sharing your time with IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind.